Today's episode of the Inside EVs podcast is brought to you by E-Range EV Tyre. E-Range EV tyres are specifically engineered for electric vehicles. Using an advanced manufacturing process called liquid phase mixing, E-Range EV's EcoPoint 3 technology creates a tyre with lower rolling resistance and longer range, while offering low levels of wear and high grip. All this while staying affordable. Go to erangetyres.com. That's E-R-A-N-G-E tyres.com to find your EV's next set of tyres.
Hello, and welcome to the Inside EVs podcast for May the 5th, 2023. This is episode number 161. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we'll be talking about the reopening of orders for the Ford Mustang Mach-E with the lower price and more range and power, the return of the Tesla Model 3 long-range dual motor with less range, and the Porsche Taycan GT may be joining that lineup. Of course, much, much more. I'm Don Macchione, Inside EV's editor and forum moderator. Joining us today is the scrupulous Mr. Tom Logney, senior editor at Inside EV's and host of the YouTube channel State of Charge. And Kyle Connor joins us from the majestic, practically palatial halls of Unspec Studios, where he produces high voltage videos for a number of YouTube channels. So welcome, everybody.
Hey, guys. Morning.
Hey, so unfortunately, Martin couldn't be with us this week. If I remember correctly, I believe he said something about a coronation, which was unexpected. I had no idea he was the next in line for the throne, let alone to become the King of England. But anyway, next week, I guess we'll have to refer to him as Your Highness. But so we'll see how that goes. So let's kick this thing off with the shenanigans you guys have been up to this week. So Kyle, let's start with you. So last week, you shared your story of attempting a cross-country cannonball. So if anyone missed that video, you should go out and check it out. We don't need to go through all that again, of course, but I did want to mention that you posted a video from that trip a few days ago focused on your escort car, the Polestar 1, which was driven by Alyssa, and she had Michaela with her. And so if you're looking for an enjoyable way to pass like an hour or so, that video is up there on Kyle's Out of Spec Motoring channel. So I also noticed, Kyle, that you have a video up on that channel as well with you and Timon road tripping from Pasadena to Phoenix, about 360 miles or so in the Lucid Air. And you use that video to talk about big range versus fast charging speeds. So that's something people can check out as well. Actually, though, did you want to share anything, or whether you like had a change of heart about charging speed versus range? Because your stance has always kind of been that you think fast charging is more important than big range. Has that changed somewhat until we get like more of a fast charging infrastructure installed?
Yeah, it all comes down to the interplay of the car and the infrastructure. And right now, you want to avoid as much of the infrastructure as possible, is my impression. You know, especially on the West Coast. So having the big range of the Lucid, what we were able to do is actually 394 miles or 396 miles one way, was we were able to charge to about 95%, drive all the way to Phoenix. We arrived at 1, and we were on the east side of Phoenix. We were over in Mesa, and we were visiting New, so they had a charger there if we wanted to test out. So we plugged in, charged it back up to full, and then we were able to blast back to the Los Angeles area. And, you know, for 99% of use cases where people are spending their time around town or they're doing these 100, 150-mile days, pretty much any electric car works perfectly for that. You know, if you drive really far, no one's ever going to complain about having more range in their car. It's just, I still think charging speed's way more important than range. Because what's so nice to be able to do is once you exhaust all that range in your car, it all comes down to the recharging times, which is how many kilowatt hours can I add in a short period of time with the efficiency of the car played in, so that you can spend 10 or 15 minutes at a charger and then maybe skip one and hop to the next. And that is, that's a new test that we do. It's called the 10% challenge. And you'll see a whole bunch of cars run through the 10% challenge. I think it's really fun. And it's all about what is the road tripping range of a car. That's probably the most important metric of a vehicle.
Okay. Tom, you have any thoughts about on that real quick? Like range versus.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were handing it over already.
Yeah. No.
So it's always, as Kyle said, it's always going to be sort of a combination of, you know, how far will it go? How fast will it charge? And as far as the infrastructure is concerned, until we have, you know, ubiquitous electric vehicle public charging stations, which we're going to get, I don't know at what point, but they're going to be everywhere. And that's going to make a huge difference. And it's going to allow the ranges to be lower, because as one of the real important things that Kyle said in the very beginning when he started talking about this was the fact that, you know, a high percentage of people, you know, are just driving around town a high percentage of the time, you know, and you're talking about a smaller use case for long distance travel, and even smaller for frequent long distance travel. So the whole charging versus range thing I find really interesting. And we've been talking about this for years on how everybody is racing to get longer and longer ranges. But then I truly believe once we have ubiquitous public charging infrastructure that works, consistently works at least, I think the ranges are going to pull back. And I really believe, you know, let's say towards the end of next decade, 2035 to 2030 to 2040, your electric vehicle ranges are going to be lower. I think the average EV is going to be about 200 miles per charge. Really? And that's going to be fine because, you know, we're not going to, you'll stop for 5 minutes and get 50% range added, you know, and that's all it'll be, 5 to 8 minutes, you know, at the fast charger that's on the corner by your street. You won't be driving 20 miles to it. And it'll be a quick 5 to 8 minute stop, and you'll add back 100, 120 miles. So, you know, it's real interesting. I wish we could, you know, jump to 25 years from now. And I think we'll be laughing about how we were fighting over range and charging speed and these broken chargers that don't work. And because that's all going to work itself out. But I mean, it's fodder for us to talk about now, but I really think that's where we're going. I think if we could, you know, leap 20 years from now, you're going to see shorter ranges, quicker charging time, ubiquitous fast charging, you know, and a lot of slower level two charging. It'll be everywhere, you know, and that's really, I think, the end game is where we're at. I don't really necessarily see it being battery swap, although I think that's going to be integrated in for certain use cases, which I think we're going to get to a little later in the podcast today.
Hopefully. Yeah. Yeah, so I'm thinking like 2025, 20, that far out. I'm like, I want to see like charging times, like 5 minutes, 3 minutes, you know, like flash charging, like basically.
Well, you have to get into like ultra capacitors to get to that, I think.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah, or some specialized chemistries that can really. I have no idea how it's going to be achieved, but I just think, you know, if everyone's like working on that problem and making batteries smaller as well and lighter, that. I think our technology in 20-25 years is going to be kind of like alien to what we think see now. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I'm looking 15 years is the end of next decade, you know, 2038 ish is where I was talking about. We're going to see a lot of really, you know, that's when I really think we're going to see the ranges are going to be a lot lower. Charging speed's going to be faster, and we're going to have a working cohesive national network of fast charging.
Right. But right now, I mean, people range is kind of what sells. I think people still like people want the range. But anyway, I guess that's an ongoing conversation we'll be having for what, 15, 20, 30 years.
A lot of podcasts to chat about this stuff between now and then. Right.
200 miles of range. That's surprisingly short to me, that like in my mind, like I my 88 Ford Ranger does about 200 miles on a tank of gas. Right. And it's like,
right, but you go and fill up the tank of gas when it's low with EV charging. The whole dynamic of refueling, as you know, is gonna change. It's not gonna be drive, you know, for a week and then refuel. It's gonna be bits and pieces here and there, like you do your cell phone. You know, you go to a cafe and they happen to have a plug. You plug your cell phone, and even though you're there for 5 minutes, the car is gonna be something like that. Every shopping center you go to, who knows? There might be inductive charging in every convenience stores, parking lot, and you'll pull in and without even needing to charge while you're in there for 10 minutes, it'll be charging and billing your account like this. There's so much that we're going to be getting into once you really get a little far out there time-wise.
That's the future I kind of want to see, like just pull up.
We're going to get there.
And it's stuff just happens seamlessly without, you know, you thinking about it too much. All right. So Kyle, this week has been, as usual, a pretty busy one for you. You spent some time with the BMW XM, which is a plug-in hybrid that starts at about $160,000. And you have a video up of you doing the plug-in hybrid EV coffee run, the FEV coffee run challenge. I'm not sure what that is. Do you want to talk about that real briefly?
Yeah, it's
a plug-in hybrid, but you know, yeah, just a quick.
We don't really even need to talk about it much. It's BMW's top SUV. It is the highest SUV you can buy from BMW. And you could watch the video. I mean, it's the coffee run challenge is basically, can you drive around town in electric without getting annoyed? Which is, it's a driving dynamics review of the electric powertrain within a PHEV. Because as you'll notice, or as you'll note from Tom talking about Pacifica plug-in hybrid, sometimes you can't even get that car in electric mode, especially when it's cold outside. And so this is all about the intricacies of how much electric driving can you actually do in a plug-in? Because I think the idea is you drive it electric in the city, and then you can skip all the failing charging infrastructure out on the highway. And that seems to be a pretty good interplay. But in reality, most plugins suck to drive electric. This one wasn't very smooth. It had a lot of range, had a lot of acceleration, but it was very clunky because the electric motor's pre-transmission. And usually that's not like the worst thing, but the tuning was really bad on this one, especially for $160,000 starting price.
Right. So, yeah, I enjoyed your thoughts on that car. What's the range on it, the all-electric range?
It was always showing over 40 miles for me. It's a guesso meter.
So that's decent.
And I was like, you know, you can go wide open throttle easy in electric mode to the kickdown switch when you lock it in electric. So I just drove everywhere to the kickdown switch. And even then it was showing that much range. So really good. Had a 25-ish or 27-ish kilowatt hour battery pack.
So that car is also at the beginning of this other video you made where you catch a flight to LA, I think, and then rent the manager's special at Hertz. Which led you to spending a bit of time in the refreshed Kia Niro. So before we dive into all the cool stuff you saw and did in I think it was the Anaheim, actually, not LA. But did you want to share any thoughts about the Niro EV, Kia Niro EV? We have some owners on the Inside EVs forum, and I think this car gets overlooked quite a bit, actually.
Yeah.
It's not the cheapest, it's not the top. It's like just kind of in there hiding, you know?
Yeah, it's just like it's not really great at anything in particular. It doesn't have the lowest price, doesn't have the longest range, doesn't have the fastest charging. But when you package it all up, it's a really nice driving car. I'm going to do some testing on a 10% challenge, maybe a range test and a driving review, because the Kia Niro was updated this year with brand new styling. So the whole thing is a new package, and it looks great. It's very nicely integrated, and you know, just driving around here, I've just been level 2 charging it. The big charging speeds of, you know, the EGMP cars, I'm not really missing at the moment for the use case that I'm using it here. Now, if I'm going out on a trip, 77 kilowatts is way too slow for me. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, I was taking Kona EVs on a trip complaining about how slow it was. Right. So I really think they should update the charging speed in this thing. They should have done some sort of technical update beyond just styling. But driving is very comfortable. And it looks great. It's the right size. Definitely worth a look if you're looking at a reasonable car. I think even better would be to pick up one of these used in a year or two once they've kind of taken a depreciation hit. This will be a great option.
Right. It's kind of that video is kind of interesting too, because you show up at Hertz thing looking for the manager special, and you had like a whole selection of different things. Like, and also an underlines like Hertz has really thrown itself into the electric vehicle space. Like there was a ton of vehicles there at that one site, including a bunch of Polestar 1s too, which is plug-in hybrid, but it's an exotic plug-in hybrid. You wouldn't expect to see maybe one or two, but they had like 4, 5 or something there at the air, just at that location. It's kind of nuts. So Hertz has like 50,000 EVs in its fleet right now. We have a post up on Inside EVs this week, just underlining that. So you can, if you're curious, you know, you can look that up. But so you were in Anaheim this week for the 2023 edition of the Advanced Clean Transportation Exposition, Act 2003 or 2023, I guess, which is more focused on products for electric commercial fleets. So we're talking trucks and other utilitarian vehicles and chargers and the software to support them. So you have a great video where you take everyone around the floor of the exposition and talk about all the stuff you see there. Similar to, you did that recently too with another exposition. What's that one at the first of the year?
Oh, we do the CES. We did. We do a bunch of them. Pretty much every show, I try and take everyone on a full tour.
Right. I love those. And reading through the comments, other people do too. It's like saves you. It's like going being there yourself without having to deal with all the crowds and.
Yeah, we save everyone all the travel, all the nonsense. You don't even have to come. We try and just make it so you see everything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Gary Clark's giving away the punchline already. We haven't gotten to that, but we will get to it soon. Let's see. So, yeah, you have a great video where you take everyone around the floor. So do you want to talk about your impressions of the show as a whole before we get into things you actually rode or drove?
Yeah, let's talk about riding and driving because that's more fun than standing around inside a convention center.
Okay. So you got to ride and drive in a few vehicles, and I was hoping you could tell us a bit more about them. So let's start with the Nikola Tray. That's an all-electric truck from a company started by a guy who was found guilty of securities fraud and wire fraud from, let's say, exuberantly exaggerating about the abilities of the company's product to investors. So as a side note, he was supposed to be sentenced actually in January, but that's been delayed until June 21st. So he's right now he's free out on $100 million bond. But anyway, against all odds, that company has managed to stay alive and even produce and sell product since that whole debacle, which is kind of amazing to me. They must have some just interesting and talented people, but also, I don't know how. I mean, that seems like it's just a difficult thing to bounce back from, but they're doing it. So against the odds, they're out there, and you got to ride in this truck. So what can you tell us about the Tray? And I'll try to bring this up so we can see this on our screen.
Right. So I rode in they have two versions. So first of all, yes. First thing I was like, can this thing go up a hill? That was the punchline of the whole thing. Right. And it did. We drove it up a hill. I wanted to make sure in the video, we found the biggest hill we could in LA, which there's not many in Anaheim where we are right here, but we went up and accelerated up the hill. It's in the video. And at the end of the day, first of all, fleet isn't as emotionally connected to this stuff as, our viewers or passenger car buyers. They want to know what product can they buy, what's the price, what's the overall cost, and they don't really care about anything else, at least most fleet operators that I talk to. Actually, I spoke to a few fleet operators that are like, yeah, as long as we can just buy the truck, we really don't care what happened before. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is, yeah, investors were really screwed. The whole beginning of the company was just a disaster. And I'm surprised they didn't just change the name and start fresh. But props to them for going through with it. And, I spoke to some of their executive team. I spoke to a lot of their engineers before I rode in the truck. They were just all standing around. And I was like, so what the hell are you guys doing? Like, is this thing legit? Like, what do you say when people ask you about Trevor and all this crazy stuff? And they were really honestly open about the whole thing. They're like, yeah, it was not good. Like, this is all different. All those people are gone. Like, this is all legit. And, it to me, also, I know some people who went to Nikola from other companies. Like, to me, it seems okay. Like, this could be a real thing. Now, it's important to note they're not engineering and designing and producing the cab or the chassis. They're really just assembling a whole bunch of components together with their full software stack. I believe some of the battery and motor tech is unique in-house, and they're producing this full package under the Nikola brand, but it's not like Tesla Semi, which they build and engineer everything in-house. So it's not at that level. But what it is it's a fully electric Class 8 truck with the video on YouTube right now, as of 50 minutes ago, the full thing is up and you can go watch it. Yep, it's ready to rock and roll, and it was really cool. It was my first experience ever in a big truck, and it was really quiet, felt really powerful, and overall was just really cool to have like Euro trucks in the U.S. I mean, we used to have cab overs in the 70s and whatever, and I love seeing old cab overs still on the road. But this is so neat. Tom, have you done anything with Nikola? What's your impression? Because I think you and Inside EVs have followed this story more than I have. I was definitely one of those naive people that it's like, oh, Nikola, that's a scam. Like, that'll never be a thing. And then they have hundreds of these already on sale and building more, and the hydrogen version launching in just a few weeks, which, again, it doesn't exist until it's on sale, but this is on sale.
Yeah, I personally haven't. I was early on, and I had been in communication with them for a while. But then when the whole, you know, disaster happened, they stopped responding to my emails. And so I stopped asking. And that's how I pretty much play it. If you don't respond to me, I'm not going to chase you. There's enough EV news going on out there. And so I really haven't re-engaged yet. And my position was going to be, you know, wait till they kind of get to where they are now. Like, looks like they're real. There's trucks on the road. They're functioning before I gave them any oxygen, Kyle. And, you know, so it looks like it's time to maybe re-engage and see what's going on over there. So I'm glad you had a chance to kick the tires and go for a ride and talk to some people. So, you know, I've said all along, I wish them luck. It was just when that whole disaster happened, it was like, okay, here's another black eye for the whole EV industry. Because that's what happens when these things happen. It's not just that Nikola looked bad. The whole industry looked bad. And you know, they're not the only company that was raising money and then turned out to, at the time at least, seemingly be a fraud. It seems like they're proven they were able to pick themselves up by their bootstraps and turn it into something real. But, you know, it gives people pause on the whole industry when you see things like this, when you read about this great new electric truck. Oh, wait a minute. It was rolling down a hill. It didn't even have a motor in it. You know, people are already very leery and cautious about believing electric vehicles are real. And then something like that happens and it just kind of pushes everything back.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, talking with their communications team, they're all, you know, been there a few months, but it's like a whole new group of people over there. And, you know, I'm surprised they didn't just go through and do a rebrand, but, you know, props to them. The Tray has two versions, the battery electric one that I wrote in, 733 kilowatt hour battery pack. It's one of the largest ones out there because I looked also at the eCascadia, at some of international stuff. They're like 400 or 500 kilowatt hours. So this has got the big battery. Also weighs more. It's almost, I think, 29,500 pounds, something like that. I mean, the thing's really heavy. But this isn't really positioned to be the long haul truck. The long haul truck, Nikola's vision at least, is the hydrogen stuff. And they're building out their own hydrogen network. And there were some announcements about that. And I'm totally into hydrogen as long as it's generated cleanly for heavy duty long haul applications. I'm not saying that that's an excuse to not work on electric and make electric work. And let's see how the Tesla Semi does with the mega chargers and all of these things. But infrastructure is a real problem on both sides. And it's all new. And I think it's important to explore all options of fueling these before we really settle in on what's the path. Like, diesel was the path. Obviously, we need to get away from that. So what's next? And so, yeah, overall, this was a really cool experience. It felt powerful. It felt great. I actually couldn't really see the screens from where I was, but Alyssa was filming and watching back on the video. They have these beautiful displays with the maps and all the driver data and temperature data, and they have a mobile app for your truck. So it seems like the software package is really cool. And Nikola invited us out to Arizona to do more. Of course, it's like, you know, if anything smells fishy, I'm going to let you know immediately type situation. Sure. But it is unfortunate that we have to approach these companies with such skepticism. And I have to say, I was even upfront with everyone I talked to. They're like, you know, everyone on YouTube is going to give us crap for making a video about this thing. But they're like, we know, but it's real. Like, go try it for yourself. Do whatever, you know, ask Roy, the driver, to do whatever you want. And it was pretty great. So I have to say it's definitely looking good for them. The fleet operators don't seem to care about the past, but we got to do more before I'm like, yeah, this is all great, but it's in the right direction.
I mean, I don't know. I haven't really seen any reviews of it. So I don't know what, you know, how actually operators or, you know, test drivers, you know, what their impressions are of it. You know, I drove trucks, but not quite that size. So, you know, it's even a bit beyond, I don't know exactly how that's supposed to feel with it, like a trailer on behind, but 733 kilowatt hours. That's getting into serious territory. Do you know offhand what the range is on that? They say,
well, don't know. But it would change massively depending on what you have on there.
Sure. Like the shape of the trailer, you mean?
But yeah, so here's the other thing. Because we talked to all of these, you know, heavy duty trucking companies, all of these van delivery companies that are here, there's no consistent range rating that they use across everything. And since I think it's important that we start covering fleet and commercial and big trucks more, we mm-hmm. might develop our own out-of-spec range test for commercial vehicles. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is, like, we were talking to some, like, we were talking to some engineers at like an established company that's going to be producing an electric van. And that video is coming tomorrow or in a couple of days. And they're like, we really underrate our stuff. Like, if you have nothing in the back and you drive around normally, like, you can double the range that we state. But then those guys right over there, they're like, we could never in our testing achieve even half of what they were claiming. So there's no consistent range rating here. And so I think we need to develop an out-of-spec test. Maybe we hire someone with a CDL to run it, and we do it with trailer, without trailer, you know, maybe certain loads, and create an industry standard here. It's definitely something we know how to do. We just got to apply it to commercial.
Somebody's got a name for you already here. Michael Pomorski says, I expect convoy channel coming. Yes.
Don't expect any new channels. We really have to see how this week goes, because we covered a lot of fleet topics, something we've never covered before. And there's no other people covering this. We did not see one other YouTuber at this entire thing. We were the only ones there. So we don't even know what the audience will think, if there's even a hunger for this type of information.
Right. I believe my friend Sebastian Blanco was there. I saw some posts from him on Mastodon. So that's how I knew it was even going on. But he goes every year. Right. So that is the tray. And we're looking at some nice displays. And yeah, I've got to check this video out later. That's up now. So we'll let that go. So I'm missing Martin here. I'm doing other things. All right. So you also got to drive an electric ambulance from Lightning E-Motors. Now, that sounds like it could be like a really good use case for an electric drivetrain. So how was that? And we've done things with Lightning E-Motors before too, I believe, right?
Yeah. 2 years ago, I drove, they gave us one for a week, one of their electric transits that they converted. And it was really cool. It was before the e-transit was a thing, but it wasn't like fully optimized. Like, it broke down, it wouldn't charge. And like, there were definitely some issues with the transit that we had. However, 2 years on, we DC charged this, worked great. The drivetrain tuning is much improved, and it didn't derate when we were cruising in it. So the thing is, Lightning E-Motors is different than Ford with the E-Transit, because this is the 3500 chassis, Transit. So everything from Ford's on the 1500, it's the single rear wheel, it's low payload, low carrying capacity. This is the big, juicy Transit, you know, dually in the back, that they then put their own electric drivetrain in. And what's funny is I actually met a few fleet operators that bought Lightning E-Motors transits off of our video that we did. So I'm like, oh, okay. So maybe reviewing commercial stuff does have some impact. And they said that they've been wonderful, and they were cheaper than Ford's E-Transit and more capable. I thought that was pretty interesting. Yeah. So a lot to dig into here. I'm actually going to do an E-Transit versus Lightning E-Motors video, because I still think there's some value of going with the Ford option if you can, because you get, you know, Ford dealer service, you get a warranty, you get a fully OE tested, an approved product, rather than Lightning E-Motors, which I'm not saying is bad. It just, there's no way Lightning could do the engineering work that Ford did on the E-Transit in terms of battery and powertrain and longevity, I would think, from initial glance. But the ambulance drove great. That it was really cool. It had lights, it had sirens, which was fun.
Did you turn them on?
Hell yeah, it did, allegedly.
I mean, that was a stupid question.
Yeah. We pulled in, I was hitting the air horn everywhere. It was great. And so we just had an absolute blast. And that video will come, I think, in 2 or 3 days, something like that. And it was just an epic experience. So really cool. I spoke to the guy who's buying like 100 electric ambulances for his fleet and how they're going to use it. And he invited us up to Vancouver to talk about what chargers they're going to put in, how they're going to be used. And they're like, we are way over specking these because everyone's concerned about range. So they're going biggest batteries possible. And then they're like, they same like what Tom was saying, like once they get comfortable with how they're going to use them, how they operate in different weather conditions, they'll start to lower the battery sizing to reduce cost and increase payload so that they can, you know, use them for even more things. So it's all a learning experience for everyone. Every fleet operator seems to be dipping their toes in the water with a few here, a few there, a few chargers here, a few chargers there. Mm-hmm. All test experiments, but this is the year of commercial electrification. Once this picks up, this will blow past passenger cars in terms of impact to our environment, to electric vehicle sales. You know, so one dude buying an ID4 doesn't make any difference, but someone buying 5,000 bright drop vans, you know, that's okay. We start making a difference.
Right.
Well, that's the thing, Kyle. The fleet operators know exactly. They have data on their fleets. You know, as much as we, you know, or the general public thinks they know how far they drive, you really don't. Like you don't have hard data and facts on what's your average driving, how many times a month do you go more than 100 miles a day, all that stuff. Fleet operators have it. Like if you're a good fleet op manager, you know your data. So you know exactly what vehicles in your fleet can handle. You know, let's say the new Ford electric van now has a low range, or at least a current one. And I know a lot of people were super disappointed when that came out, 126 miles EPA, which means load it up, drive it in the winter. You can bank on 75 to 80 miles. That's it.
Right.
You know,
right.
And the fleet managers know exactly what percentage of their fleet can do that. I have friends that own companies that have vans, trucks, the distributors. They know there's a certain percentage of their fleet that drives less than 80 miles a day. There's a certain percentage that drives between 80 and 100, and a certain that goes 100 to 150. So they can purchase the right size battery in the right vehicle that will fulfill that duty cycle perfectly. And I've always said this, that I'm surprised electrification didn't first start out with fleet operators and then come to passenger vehicles, because it, you know, buses and vans, delivery vans, you know, those like shuttle vans, if you go to a nice hotel that take you back and forth to the airport, they're perfect. They know exactly how far they go every day. They just run back and forth to airports. Those vehicles are perfect for EVs. We should have had tens of thousands of them, millions of them out there first, before we even started selling passenger vehicles. You know, that's how I look at it, at least. But you're 100% right. We're going to start to see that now. And in the next couple of years, the percentage of EVs that are in the public hand and currently in fleet hands, that percentage is going to change drastically.
Right. This is like the displacing the whole diesel part of the, you know, environmental issue kind of thing, you know. That's really one of the bigger, larger contributors, I think, to, or at least our air quality pollution, like it's just local pollution. I live close to the I-10 right there. It's not too far from me, and that's one of those things I kind of worry about, you know, how the emissions of the diesel particles from that, you know, might affect my health, because I've been living by the I-10 for some time now, so it's on my mind. Yeah.
Bill says mail trucks. Right, mail trucks. Parking enforcement, those cars that just drive around the city all day long, they drive all day long, and they drive like 23 miles, you know, and they're sitting idling. Every time the enforcement officer gets out to write a ticket, the car's just sitting there idling. Like all those vehicles, they should have been the first zero emission vehicles that we had out there. But hey, they're coming now.
And in our city of Fort Collins, they actually were, Tom, which is interesting. We have these old first-gen Nissan Leafs as our parking enforcement vehicles. Nice. And could you imagine a more parking enforcement car than an old Nissan Leaf? That person gets out of that thing. He's ready to write you some tickets. He means business in his old Leaf.
100%. Absolutely perfect. And that's – we're going to – I think that we're finally – it's starting to click to the fleet operators and the municipalities. You know, years ago, you guys know I had a restaurant in Montclair, and I knew everybody in Montclair, the town hall, the police department. I was trying to get them to buy municipal vehicles, even for police use around town, because the police, they don't, they don't leave Montclair. It's not like they go on highway, high-speed chases. They're not even allowed to do a high-speed chase. They have to break off when they're going like 5 miles an hour over the speed limit. So like even the police cruisers don't need to be, you know, the cars that they used to be years ago.
So now we know how Tom gets away with all his driving. You just keep going.
Well, that was the unfortunate truth, Kyle, was, you know, there were neighboring towns that maybe had higher crime rates. And when they would come to Montclair, commit a crime, they knew just drive like hell and Montclair police are going to break off. They'll radio to the next town, but they have to break off. And, you know, it's the almost all municipal truck vehicles, other than some of their heavy duty trucks for the water department and stuff that need to carry real heavy loads. At the time, there was nothing available. Now there's like the Lightning and things like that. But almost all municipal vehicles should be converted to electric at this point, because it'll save in the long run so much money, the fueling. I mean, the police, you know, they're not allowed to turn their cars off. When they, let's say they get out to, you ever go to like a convenience store and there'll be a cop car sitting out front running. And you're like, why doesn't he just shut it off? They're not allowed to, because if they get an emergency and they run out, and now let's say they have a dead battery and the car won't start, that's why they're, at least I know in the municipalities that I know, they have to leave them running their entire shift. They're not allowed to turn them off. You know how much fuel is wasted, how much pollution is created just while the cars are just sitting there? So all that stuff is perfect for EVs.
Right. Shout out to Tallahassee. We have like a full Bolt EV parking enforcement situation going on here. And they have their own yard with a lot of charge points, CPs, like around charging them up.
That's that's a good parking enforcement vehicle as well. That fits with the Bolt theme.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's great. It'd be great. If that was my job, I'd be pretty happy about that.
Dominic, you'd be a good parking enforcement person, but you would be a reasonable one. Someone would come out and you'd be like, you're only 30 seconds over. If you're 45, I'd write you.
Some people get kind of super overzealous
parking entire enforcement. Town of Colorado.
Right. I mean, I guess, yeah.
Yeah. I just back in so they can't see my plates or anything.
You don't have front plates?
No, I will never put a front plate on.
I didn't say that. I didn't do that. But
yeah.
That's what I love about living in Florida. No front plates. Oh, but before I forget, back to the Lightning e-motors ambulance. Do you know what kind of range they were talking about with those?
It was like they have a 200-mile option. But again, what drive cycle? We don't know. So right. It means nothing. Still,
200 miles.
That's... Still, you get 200 miles out of a calculator if you drive it slow. So it just depends on what, you know, how you're driving it. So I don't believe any of these range estimates, honestly. They all mean nothing.
Right. But I mean, if they say 200, you can say, well, okay, it's got to go at least 100 miles, right?
Well, you would think, but it sounds like that's not even the case for some of this stuff.
Okay.
I'm not saying Lightning e-motors doesn't do that, because I was getting about 1.5 miles per kilowatt hour in the unit that I tested. It was an unloaded one. But, you know, I think, 150 miles is reasonable. And for what they're doing all day, like Tom said, they just idle all day and then they drive 3 minutes to an emergency and then they bring them to a hospital. And the thing's pretty fast. So you can get there pretty quick, which was cool. So we did some performance testing of the Lightning e-motors ambulance, made sure it could hustle through traffic, and it can. So that was good.
Sweet. All right. So what else did you see there? So you also saw, and I didn't write this up, but the Bright Drop van you ran into, and see if I can pull up your video of that. So they had one on display on the showroom floor, at least, and they have both sizes. I believe they have two sizes of that thing, right?
Yep. So the 400 was inside, and then the Zevo 600 was outside. I drove it. It was really cool. And I drove the 600, the dual motor, single battery, 100 kilowatt hour roughly. Thought it was just insanely cool. And that video, I think, is tomorrow's video. And it was so much fun. We really need to do a Rivian EDV versus this.
I will drive that.
Yeah, great. We'll come out and we'll do a comparison of range. We got to do a track test. We got to see which one gets your packages delivered first. This was really actually not slow. This thing was juicy. It was great.
It's a Hummer EV, right? In disguise.
Basically, yeah. The steering wheel, the brake pedal, everything felt so Hummer EV. And the screens were straight out of the Hummer. And the only thing it was missing was rear steer.
Oh, rear steer would be great on this.
Yeah, I thought the turning radius wasn't good enough. So I went inside, didn't make it in the video, but they were kind of like, yeah, we wanted rear steer. Okay. But then they started talking to their customers, and the flat floor in the back was like trumped everything. And rear steer package is big and you need some room. And it was like it impacted cargo space. So they gave up turning radius for cargo space, which I guess makes sense.
Right. Maybe there's another way of engineering it, though. You know, maybe they just need to rethink. I don't know. I'm not an engineer. That's way above my pay grade, but it's kind of just a shame. But the short wheelbase should turn better anyway.
Yeah, the long wheelbase was a little bit big to maneuver around, was my impression.
Right. Okay. I'm going way too far with this video. Let me pull up your other one, though, because you do have some footage. So you have the full video coming up tomorrow, you say?
On the Bright Drop, yeah, we have so many queued up. I don't know what goes up when, but within a couple of days, yes.
Okay, let me show you all this little. Like
the perfect opportunity to do so. No one is around. I'm going to come to a stop here. We're going to brake boost it.
I hear myself.
So, yeah, you're talking. You're doing a little acceleration testing.
Yep. Did a little wide open launch. It doesn't give you much power at zero, but once you're at 30 miles an hour, this thing rips.
Okay. And then it has like huge regeneration too, right? Like huge power levels.
Yeah. It felt just like Hummer. I mean, I don't know if it probably will do 250 kilowatt regen would be my guess at higher speed, really? Because you lift off and it's just, and there's a setting to turn one pedal drive on and off and you can, you know, do D and L. It's honestly all the same as Hummer. It was really interesting.
That's a great, that's really,
really want that for vans, you know, for these delivery vans, that real heavy regen. They stop so frequently, you know, it really will help extend the range and less, you know, maintenance for brake pads, it's a big expense for fleet operators, brakes.
I used to deliver brakes and wheels parts to our local city, we had the school bus contract or something. So like huge brakes and wheels. I have to lug those over, and that's a really expensive thing to have to deal with, because that takes a vehicle out of service for a while. And these guys, you know, you got to pay these guys to do all that stuff. And like this much regen, I would bet you they won't need to change those pads. And like, I have no idea what I couldn't say, but I would not be surprised if ever, like, 100,000 miles. I don't know.
Oh, more than that, I would think, because you can do all your stop and go without touching the brake pedal.
Is it like, yeah? You really don't need to touch the brakes.
You don't need to at all.
Wow. Wow. That's pretty awesome.
It does some brake blending with one pedal drive right at the end to hold you, but it brings you to pretty much a stop. And then it just, the friction brake isn't really any friction. It's just to hold you there. So,
Do you know really if it's permanent magnet motors? No,
they are.
It is. Yeah. Okay. So they could bring you to a stop as well. Without the brake, but you know, brakes of course make it that much more secure. All right. So you also got to check out the Silverado EV, Chevy Silverado EV, but in work truck spec. And I think I have a couple pictures here I can share. And yeah, so what was your impression? Is this the first time you see this live, this truck?
No, so I've seen other trim levels of this truck before, but it's the first time we're seeing the work truck. And it looked great. I mean, it's a pickup truck supposed to do what it needs to do, which is haul stuff.
Right.
They really should have called it the Avalanche, not the Silverado, but it's very avalanche-y. But it's cool. I mean, it's everyone was into it. I talked to a whole bunch of fleets and I was like, this or F-150, what are you thinking? Or the Ram thing. Everyone kind of was thinking this was great. Heard some comments about the front trunk not being as big as F-150 Lightning, or at least wide. Mm-hmm. Heard some people asking about 240 volt power. I kind of stayed around the truck a little bit for 5 minutes or so just to hear what people were asking. So definitely, like, Chevy should have benchmarked F-150 Lightning in certain areas. My impression is this is going to be, especially with the big battery, much faster charging, much more range. And probably a more, you know, just a elevated experience, I would think, from a driving standpoint than the Lightning in terms of power. And they're just going to crank up the dials more. And then Ford's going to come out with the next Lightning and crank up the dials even more.
Yeah. It's going to be great.
Race starts.
Yeah. I mean, Ford did a really great job of getting the F-150 Lightning out there fast, you know, and it's a good product Tom, you own one, right? And yeah, it's a great product. But you know, Chevy might have them, something on them here. But Ford's going to come back with you know their new product. It's going to be really interesting in the whole pickup space over the next few years for sure. And of course the Ram Rev, the thing from Well, I guess going to just call it the Rev, right?
They had the prototype Ram Rev there, not even the production one, which I thought was weird. So they had the prototype like on display in a back corner somewhere.
Okay.
What is this doing here? Because it's not like they have the full ready to go Silverado work truck. I was really surprised Ford didn't bring a Lightning to the event. But what was crazy was driving through the parking garages on the way up. You know, a lot of municipalities come and see this place. So like Pasadena had an ID4 and then like everyone else brought their F-150 Lightnings that they use for their city. Like San Luis Obispo had their Lightning, a whole bunch of others. Just, you know, base either Pros or XLT Lightnings filled the parking garages. It was so cool to see all of that. And so, you know, Ford's got the fleet contract side of things that they've built that business over years. And honestly, they own that space. So it was a very natural fit for them to sell Mach-E in certain cases, but especially Lightning to many of their existing fleet customers. And I think everyone's loving them. I mean, I can't hear one bad thing about them. So I'd love to. If you hate it, let me know. But everyone's just raving about these things because they're so versatile. They're so great to drive. And yeah, certainly electric doesn't work for every application, but especially like Tom was saying, municipalities, you're in your little area. It's perfect.
Yeah. And I'm starting to see a lot of Lightning in municipal fleets just on the road, like with utility markings on it or township. And one thing I didn't even mention when I did the Tesla Magic Dock video back a couple months ago with my Lightning, when I was leaving, a Lightning pulled in that was like the city of where we were, like their public works department. And because there's a Dunkin' Donuts at that location. And so I asked the guy, I was like, oh, how do you like it? And he didn't even realize mine was the Lightning because it's black, you know, and it's not all labeled up. And he was like, oh my God, we love this. We fight over who gets to take it out every day. And he's like, it's just, you know, it just drives so well. And he was like, I would have never thought I would have liked an electric truck, but these are great. So, you know, but again, use the right tool for the right job. There's still plenty of applications for pickup trucks that it quite honestly, gas or diesel vehicles will work better, but it's only a matter of time before the electric vehicles catch them in most categories, at least.
Right. So was there anything else at the show that I didn't mention that you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, because those were all the vehicle side of things, which was honestly maybe 5% of the show. So okay. Do we have another like 4 hours that we could go into the rest?
I mean, people can watch the video.
Yeah. So the video there covers the high level. I mean, I think just to get people the impression of the show, so you don't have to watch that 1 hour long video if you don't want. Right.
Sure.
It's okay, so like for fleet electrification, there's a couple sides of the business. You have the end product, the actual stuff that they'll be driving, which we talked about in this show. You have to figure out how to fuel and charge those vehicles. So charging was, at least for me, it's my most interesting topic. I mean, that's what I'm interested in. And so all the charging companies were there. We saw ABB, we saw ChemPower stuff. Autel had a big booth. ChargePoint had a big booth. BTC Power did, Flow did. I mean, everyone was there. And it was really cool to see everyone's new chargers in a fleet-specific form talking about that. Then there's also this other business which doesn't get talked about much, which is like the charging coordination business. And it's a whole bunch of companies, plenty of them out there, that install and manage and software control charging installations for fleets. So you have the manufacturers, you have the resellers, you have the integrators, and then you have the fleets. And you know, everyone's just trying to take a little bit of money, build their business somewhere in this space. We'll see how this all plays out years into the future. I hope it gets to the point where installing charging is just easy and ubiquitous. But right now, that's not the case. One of the biggest hurdles to electrification of fleets right now is the infrastructure. And it is the biggest hurdle. That is the conversation of the entire show, is grid connections, utilities can't get us the power. What are we going to do? We need to electrify, but we can't charge this stuff. A lot of businesses lease their buildings, lease their parking lots. They're looking at you know, millions of dollars worth of investment in charging, and then what, they're just going to leave it in the ground. So there's lots of unique, I would say, mobile charging applications, battery buffered charging applications that are coming, and those aren't cheap, but it might be cheaper than paying, you know, $30 million. I heard one company got quoted just to bring power to power their fleet. That's before they even put the chargers in the ground. And that's because they needed a substation upgrade, which would then go, because it was just insane. So the topic of this year is all about, how are you going to power your fleet? Once you can get the power, then you can buy the vehicles. So and utilities were there. We met with a bunch of them. We're going to do some videos on, you know, grid, looking at stuff. I told them I want to plug in a Hummer and watch the scale, you know, on the power station go up. And one of them said, yeah, we could probably arrange that. They were like a rural charging place. So that would be pretty cool. There's a lot of really interesting things going on with fleets, and mobile charging was a big topic. The other side of it is, of course, construction equipment that you can't charge at all. You know, you're literally building in the middle of a field. How are you supposed to charge this thing? So they had like off-road half a megawatt hour, like pods that would be remote controlled out, that had big suspension and knobby tires. And it was just a half a megawatt hour battery pack on wheels.
Right.
So cool. And they're like, yeah, you can DC fast charge this thing. You can remote control it over to Electrify America and fill it up or whatever you want to do. And really a cool experience there. So the whole show is all about this side of fleet charging. But then the other half is hydrogen. And hydrogen is really was a big topic here. There are fleet operators who just won't consider electric. They're like, we do long distance. We own our own depots. We're going to put in our own hydrogen electrolyzers and fueling stations and, you know, and do their trucks. But I'm not against it, because I think the bigger the application, the more hydrogen makes sense. It's a lighter technology than putting a bunch of batteries in something. You still need some batteries, but you're saving 5,000 to 8,000 pounds on a semi truck going hydrogen, you know, electric to hydrogen. You're putting a lot less material in there that you have to mine up and do all this stuff to get the batteries. Because again, most of these are low volume vehicles where they're not getting the cream of the crop batteries with all this tracing of where they're coming from. You know, this is the stuff you don't want in your car and in your vehicle. And, you know, if you can generate it through an electrolyzer cleanly, it's not the end of the world. You know, a Mirai, that's stupid. But, you know, an electric semi or a hydrogen semi truck, that is pretty neat. It could work pretty well for some people.
Yeah, I try not to be too, you know, close-minded about hydrogen, you know, but it's just, oh, man. Sometimes I feel like the more technologically advanced the solution is, the more, you know, people will kind of glom onto it because it's a lot of, you know, is it because it is technologically maybe beyond their sort of understanding how it all kind of works. But yeah, I'd like to see, you know, really on a level playing field, you know, the cost of a battery electric truck and the cost of running a hydrogen truck for, say, a 5-year cycle.
We're going to do it. Planning a video on diesel versus electric versus hydrogen. And we're going to actually go over to Nikola and do that. So I basically said, just drop a electric truck, drop a hydrogen truck in the back of the lot. Don't tell us what to do. And they're like, yeah, sure. Whatever. Yeah, that sounds great. I think they're really trying to work on their reputation.
Sure.
And I was like, well, and then bring, you know, get us in a comparable diesel truck. Let us do the range tests. Let us do the charging and the refueling time. Let us do the cost analysis with actual fleet operators who are looking at these, because the cost will be known. Yeah. And actual cost, of course.
Right.
So that could be an interesting area for us to get into.
Sure.
And Dom, one of the things that I think, and you're saying you're trying to explain why people might latch on to hydrogen more than they are willing to accept electricity. Part of it, I think, also is because it really replicates what they're used to.
Sure.
Refueling with hydrogen really is basically the same thing as refueling with gasoline. You go to a station, there's a pump. In a few minutes, you're full and you're good for 300 or 400 miles. When with electrification, we're asking people to change their habits. We're asking them to change what they're used to. And while people don't enjoy getting gasoline, nobody enjoys going to a gas station and getting gasoline. Well, nobody should, you know, but that they're used to it. And, you know, it's, we call it like the devil, you know, everyone's right. Very comfortable with going to a gas station, filling up and being good for 300 or 400 miles. Now with EVs, we're telling people, well, you know, you can plug it into a household outlet and it'll take 3 days, or you can get a level two outlet. And now it only takes 8 hours. Or when you're on the road, you can find these fast chargers that sometimes work. And it might take you 3 hours if you're at a low power DC fast charger. It could take you an hour, could take you 40 minutes, but stop charging at 80%, because at 80%, it slows down. And now, you know, also you might hurt your battery if you charge to 100%. Mm-hmm. We're throwing all this crap at people with regards to charging. And they're like, okay. The hydrogen is just like gas, right? I just go there, refill, I fill it to 100%, I leave and I drive away. Okay, that's it. My life is hard enough. I don't want to learn all this other stuff. I think right. That's a big part of why people might seem to be more receptive, or some people are more receptive to transitioning from gas and diesel to hydrogen more so than they are with electric.
Yeah. And the other, there's two components of this. On the passenger car side, if you live in LA and don't have home charging, hydrogen was actually better as an owner experience, because you're not having to go fight for that last DC fast charger. You may have to wait in line at a hydrogen station, but it's just like a gas station you go through. And when I had the Mirai, I was just boop, right up to 100%. I had 400 something miles in a few minutes, and, you know, way better than plugging in a Model 3 to a supercharger for an hour to get to 100%, because they slow down at 80 or 90%. So that, Tom is correct in that. There are use cases where hydrogen is a better ownership experience. I still think passenger car hydrogen is really silly. I don't recommend it. But then on the big truck side, Dom, there's no MCS doesn't exist right now. There is no high power charging standard. Now, Tesla builds their own chargers and their own trucks, and they're using their own connector to get 750, you know, kilowatts to a megawatt of charging power. In the wide industry, when you're selling to fleets and they have to install infrastructure, they have to install infrastructure that they can buy. UPS is not in the business of building trucks or chargers. So they have to buy a truck and they have to buy a charger that work and talk to each other. And right now, battery electric, the fastest charging battery electric truck there was the Nikola Tre battery electric that could do 350 kilowatts. The eCascadia could only do 240 with two CCS ports. You had to plug two in at once. And I was like, what are y'all doing over here? Like, let's get some high power stuff. We're just starting to see the MCS triangle handle, the megawatt charging standard. It's like rated for 2 or 3 megawatts. We're starting to see displays of that on chargers with cables that don't exist. They're just like literally hooked up to CCS cables. The communication is using ISO 15118-2, which is just adapted CCS to go over to MCS. They're not using their new protocol because it doesn't exist yet. Right. So there's real no standard for charging above 500 kilowatts to a megawatt using existing technology. It's like no one can even charge fast. And now hydrogen's here saying, hey, look, just drop in a station and fill this thing up. And like Tom's saying, in just a few minutes. So there's no fast charging capabilities for these trucks right now. Tesla Semi is really the only one, but you can't buy that because it's a years long wait list.
Right. And then when you do buy it, there's still no network for it to charge it. You can do it in your Home Depot. Tesla will install a megawatt charger in your depot, but there's nothing, you know, you can't go across country with it.
Basically. Same with hydrogen. There's no hydrogen or electric heavy duty network right now. So that's all, you know, we've heard Nikola through their, I can't remember the name, but whatever they do are for their hydrogen business, they're working to build out a network of hydrogen filling stations. I talked to the company that's going to be like doing the hard work on that. They were pretty cool. I thought we'd make some videos together because they're also building battery electric charging hubs, which I thought was an interesting business model. And well, I would like to get Tom's impression on this. Tom, this company, and I wish I could remember the name of them right now, but Alyssa's in contact with them. We'll make some videos. They're just like people build along highways, these massive buildings, these storage centers, these future factories, these open metal shell buildings, wait for people to come lease them and then adapt them for their needs. They're building charging hubs alongside of those new construction buildings. They're going to own them, put in the chargers, and then when someone leases the building, they'll lease them the charging hub or sell them the charging hub right next to it. So that you're reducing that 2 or 3 year time period to put in your business.
Yeah, that sounds great. Land grab now, getting ahead of it and not having to. So, but what are they already accounting for the infrastructure? Are the sites going to be ready to drop the units in? Are they paying to upgrade their yes. delivery and all that? Yeah. Okay. That's great. Yeah. I mean, that's, they must be well funded and they'll, if they do it right, they'll benefit long term for sure.
Yeah. So they're thinking like 10-year leases. They'll hold the assets after that as well. I mean, it was a really interesting business model that we haven't seen before. So that's what I'm going to explore a little bit more.
Interesting.
Yeah, excellent.
All right. We're about to jump into some news, I guess. Anything else you want to mention real quick?
Nope. It just as to sum this all up, the industry is confused, but right now everyone's speaking the same language. You didn't have to explain to one person in there kilowatt or kilowatt hour or, 400 versus 800 volt or amps. Everyone's on the same, communication standard now, which it sounds like in years past, everyone was like, "Whoa, what's a charger?" So like everyone gets it. The whole industry has moved along. They understand a lot. We met a lot of viewers there. So thanks to everyone we met. It was great to hang out. Hundreds of people, maybe even thousands. I don't know. We met so many people who watch our videos, this podcast. It was really great and learned a lot. It was really an eye-opening experience for me. So fleet and commercial will be a larger part of our coverage going forwards.
Right. So look out on your videos coming out this week. Are they going to be on the AutoSpec Reviews channel?
Most of them, yes.
Okay. So, keep an eye out for those. And I'm looking forward to watching some of those. So Tom, you didn't drive anything this week, but I should mention that you have a charger review coming up tomorrow to we should keep an eye out for.
Yeah. I might even put up later today if I can get it done. A lot of people have been asking me to do some of the portable charging equipment reviews more than just the permanently mounted ones. So I grabbed one of the Webasto units, the Webasto Go, it's called. It's a dual voltage, 120 volt, 240 volt unit. It's pretty good. It's a pretty solid unit. It's what Ford includes with their Lightning and the Mustang Mach-E. And it's a real solid unit. It actually did pretty well. There were a couple of failures in the review. It is IP67 rated, which means that it should be waterproof for up to 3 feet of water for 30 minutes. And that's one of the tests it failed. So, but the interesting thing about this, if you remember, I reviewed the Paragear 2 a couple months ago, and that had a catastrophic failure. It was also supposed to be watertight, but when I put it in the water, it blew up and it melted, but the Webasto didn't. It faulted. So it recognized water was intruding into the adapter and shut off charging. But then when it dried out, it worked fine. So it was a failure, but not a catastrophic failure, which is good to see. If water does get into that adapter somehow, you don't ruin your $500 charger like what happened with the Paragear where it just fried. But that's a difference between Webasto, an established company that's been making electric vehicle charging equipment for many years, very, all safety certified equipment. They partnered with many OEMs, not just Ford. They've partnered with at least a dozen OEMs to provide them charging equipment versus a new upstart Asian company that is trying to sell EV charging equipment for under $200. It's a race to the bottom. Go on Amazon, click, electric vehicle charger, lowest price, and boom, buy that one. That's not what you do, but a lot of people do, and you get equipment that is faulty, sometimes dangerous. I always recommend people don't buy the cheapest charger out there. Buy a good quality one, and it'll last you many years. And unfortunately, the Webasto did fail the weatherproof rating test. But other than that, it's a pretty darn good unit, and it's definitely one of my recommended portable chargers.
And of course, that's going to be on your State of Charge YouTube channel. So if you have if you haven't done this already, go to State of Charge. Click that bell icon and you'll get a notification when his Webasto review goes up and you can check that out.
I want to talk about Tom's just review process here for a second, because Tom has captured and won the level 2 EV review space. You know, when we talk about EVSEs, everyone, you know, Tom is just EVSE. Tom's the first next thing that comes into everyone's head. And I was at ChargePoint recently, and it's a video we didn't get to talk about last time, I don't think, but I posted a 2-hour-long video with ChargePoint, really opening up the hood, seeing all their engineering. It was just absolutely epic. And when I was talking to some of the folks who designed the Home Flex, I was talking to them over there. Everything was like, how do we do better in Tom's test? It was like, you know, they have the best cable. That was the first thing they told me. They said, oh, Tom loves our cable. And so, you know, he's really got these companies engineering their products around this testing here. And, you know, Monroe's starting to do some of this level 2 teardowns and stuff like that. As much as I love the guys over there, I'm just not sure it's so helpful because they don't talk about anything on the user experience side. It's cool to see what's in there, but they don't show you what app you need, how you plug in the charger. They're not doing cable drop tests or freeze tests. That Tom's really doing the user, you know, what we care about review. They're doing maybe a little bit more industry benchmarking stuff, which is their business anyway. So anyway, there's probably a place for both, but everyone's just talking. Whenever I talk to these level 2 companies, Tom, they're like, oh, you do this podcast with Tom. Well, let them know we're working really hard on this. So yeah, it's been pretty cool.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Kyle. Thanks a lot. And talking about the Monroe thing, you know, I talked to them about that. I talked to Corey and Sandy about the fact that they were going to start doing some teardowns on chargers. And I actually offered, I said, look, you guys handle the engineering end of it really well. You could rip it apart and show this little connector here is going to fail if it gets overused. They should have used a different type of connection here. You know, I don't like the circuit board, all the stuff that, you know, I'm not going to really get that deep. My videos are already a damn hour. I can't make them any longer. But I offered to them, why don't we do this in conjunction? Like if I review the ChargePort charger from a user's perspective, then you do the teardown, we could cross link our videos. And didn't seem like there was an appetite on their end to do that. I just thought that would be an awesome comparison to you know, okay, you know, and now after I've done my user review, why don't you jump over to Monroe? That they're going to tear this thing down and show you the engineering side of it. But unfortunately, I don't think that they wanted to do that. I thought that would be a fantastic 1-2 punch.
Yeah, that'd be great. Hey, so if you're not watching this on YouTube right now, I've been showing up on the screen this video that Kyle did last week, of his tour of the ChargePoint facility there, which I believe you talked about a little bit last week.
Okay, yeah, couldn't remember. But yeah epic video if you want to see inside.
But it's a really great video, and there was like a rave reviews about it in the comments. I didn't have a chance to watch the whole thing yet, but yeah. It looks like a pretty intense sort of lab research center, development center.
Actually, they have. If you just scroll forward, we can show the audience here so they don't have to watch the whole thing. If you just go over to it's all the way towards the end, the reliability test portion of it. Yeah, go into here. You can just see, just laboratories upon laboratories. Keep moving along a little bit farther along as well. This is where they torture test all their chargers. This was the coolest part of the whole video. They got labs, they got, you know, robots yanking on the cables, they're putting them in, you know, super heat soaked rooms. If you're interested at all in charging, this is a good video to watch. And honestly, I think it sets the benchmark for when we go to other companies, what are they doing to make sure their stuff's going to work? Because we talked about the business model, we talked about the pros and the cons, and there are some cons to ChargePoint's business model from the driver perspective, because once the equipment goes out there, it's not theirs anymore, it's someone else's. And it's up to them to maintain it. But ChargePoint is actively working on solutions to that. It was just epic to watch how they really engineer the hell out of this stuff. It was so cool.
This is trying to break this to the freezer part. Is this the freezer?
Yes, this is the freezer. This is where they run the charger flat out at minus 40 or minus 50.
And it's cold.
Actually, it was really cold, yeah.
Yeah, GM has some rooms like this in their battery testing center that I got to see.
Yeah. ChargePoint has like almost 20 of these things, all running different testing on different products. It was really cool.
Yeah, that's cool. I wanted to bring that up just because that was it's a great video and people should check that out if they're interested at all in that.
My freezer over here gets down to negative 20.
Yeah, that's good.
ChargePoint did laugh at that. They were like, yeah, that freezer in Tom's place, he needs to get a colder one.
Okay. Oh, there we go. Maybe we should start a GoFundMe for a super heavy duty, like minus 60.
You should get one of those environmental test chambers.
I might have to, but I don't know. -20 is pretty good. That's probably going to do 99% of use cases. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, when I pull them out of there, I leave them in for 24 hours at -20. If I don't wear gloves, my hands hurt.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just from picking them up and hanging it on the wall, and you can immediately see the cables frost starts, you know, as soon as it hits the warm air out here. So they're pretty cold in there.
Right on. All right. Let's talk about some news real quick. We got some time. Yep. So, all right. In the news this week, the Ford Mustang Mach-E is back after the factory in Mexico has been upgraded for a production ramp in the second half of this year. So the company has reopened its order books and the car has slightly also improved. So it will cost a bit less now, as well as get a free 90-day Blue Cruise 1.2 trial. And so basically standard range models will all have LFP batteries now. And the rear wheel drive versions get 250 miles of range and the all wheel drive versions, 226 miles of range with a standard battery. They have a larger one as well. Power output is up as well, with the E all-wheel drive, the dual motor configuration, getting 45 more horsepower. So that cuts the 0-60 time for the Mach-E standard range all-wheel drive down to 5.1 seconds, which is, you can't complain about 5.1 seconds, 0-60 in a small battery. So that's great. And of course, because it's LFP, the standard battery can also be charged to 100%. So when you're on the road, it can also supposedly also charge 5 minutes quicker than previously, going from 10 to 80% in 33 minutes, which is not spectacular, but it's not the worst either, right?
It's on par to be close to the worst. No,
what's Toyota BZ4X?
It's actually not that bad. It's actually, I think it's longer than this. But right. BZ4X is like from the 80 to 100 takes like hours.
Right.
But
right.
The actual up to 80 wasn't so bad. Ford's never been into fast charging.
Right. They had that weird fast charge situation where they give you a lot of power for a short period of time and then drops back down.
Yeah, it's because they chose really thin cables. They can't overheat them.
Right. So but finally,
the trick for that is just unplug and replug in. That'd get another boost. You might fry your cables, but
right. So the prices are also cheaper, which is kind of a big deal. So some of them are cheaper by as much as $4,000 for some trims. So while I pull up the list here of those prices and things, Tom, can you give us your thoughts on this move a little bit?
So I mean, new pricing, lower pricing is always better for the consumer. You know, and I thought it was interesting that Jim Farley, Ford CEO, talked about how this current, like, brought on by Tesla, you know, he kind of admitted that this price war and their reaction here was to Tesla lowering their prices, which, you know, that's no secret. But right. I found it interesting that he talked about how Ford learned something many years ago, or at least Henry Ford did, that it's not necessarily the best policy to do this price war. And when when Henry Ford saw that the Model T, the orders were starting to sag, you know, it was just kept every year. They were selling more and more and more. When as it went on the downslide, what he did was drop pricing. And right. He said that it actually didn't work, you know, and it did for a very short initial boost, but then that was it. And it ended up angering customers that had paid more only, you know, just 6 months ago. And now their vehicles are devalued. And, you know, I mean, it could just be CEO speak that he doesn't like the fact that he had to lower his prices, or there could be something to it there that, you know, you see how upset Tesla owners get when, you know, they just spend $80,000 on a car. And then the next week it's for sale for $72,000. So, you know, there's something to that. And maybe it's beyond my pay grade understanding the psyche of consumer behavior, but lower prices is good for the consumer.
Yeah.
Is Ford losing money? Is Model E, you know, really sucking it right now financially? Yeah. But you got to expect that.
Yeah,
Tesla lost a tremendous Model E, Ford's Model E, and all of the car companies now that are starting to sell EVs, it's almost like they have startups within their companies. It's not it's not like just a new brand. And BMW, I talked to BMW about this years ago. You guys know I had a lot of conversations with BMW in the early days. And that's why they formed BMW i, because they really wanted to keep all the expenses and everything in a separate fishbowl. So they really understood the how bad it was and how much money they were pouring into. I mean, that's not the only reason, but it was one of the reasons why they separated it, because it was like its own venture. And Ford's Model E is the same way. They're going to lose billions of dollars. I think this year, was it $2 billion or something they were going to lose, or whatever it was. Look at Tesla back up until 2018. I think it was 2015 to 2019. In those 4 years or those 5 years, they lost $6 billion Tesla. And yeah, and that's going to happen with all of these car companies now. And do they wish that they could have higher margins and they didn't have Tesla pulling down the prices and making them be more competitive? Oh, sure they do. But, you know, it's the cost of this transition. The transition to EVs is going to be very painful for all of the existing OEMs. It's going to cost them billions of dollars, but they have to do it, and they have to be as competitive as they can right now. And this is Ford's way of trying to be competitive with the Mach-E. They had to lower the prices. I think right. The transition to the LFP battery pack for standard range Lightning and Mach-E's is fantastic. I think that's the best move to make. And hopefully that'll give them a little bit of leeway financially, because they're going to cost a little bit less. But I think that's just a better battery pack for the Ford Pro and for standard range Mach-E anyway. So, you know, this is really not a surprise to me. And Tesla's really, really putting pressure on all these other companies. I mean, if all the other companies hated Tesla before, with this recent round of price, you know, drops, they're really, you know, really wishing that they would have done something years ago when they could have to stifle Tesla, and it's too late now.
Well, Elon said he was trying to, you know, be more competitive in that way, just trying to keep market share. So he's, you know, dropping prices and just putting the price pressure on the competition now. Yeah. So, but Patrick and Liv from Mach-E Vlog bring up a good point. So part of the pricing difference is the LFP battery savings, mm-hmm. and they've implemented about $1,000 from manufacturing savings. So they're streamlining the production and saving some money there that helps them cut these prices. But they also, the Mach-E Vlog also says, boost delivery fees and now charge $500 if you want that portable charger. So yeah, that's one way.
It's still cheaper than buying it directly from Webasto. Webasto sells it for $550. So
right.
And I'm fine with charging for charging equipment, to be honest with you. I know that a lot of people upset. I'm fine with not including charging equipment with the car. I think in the earliest days that was important, because nobody knew where to go. Nobody understood EV charging. You had to include it. But now there's so many companies out there willing to sell you equipment, and there's so many different ways you could do it, whether plug-in, hardwire. Why include something in a vehicle if the person doesn't need it? Like if I went out and bought a new Mustang Mach-E now, or Kyle bought one, we don't need the charger with the car. Why? And that has to get built into the price. You're paying for it. So like with my Lightning, I didn't need that portable charger. I've got 1,000 of them in here. You know, and a lot of owners, they don't have 1,000 of them, but a lot of owners, it's their second and third EVs. They already have charging equipment. So I'm fine with not including charging equipment with EVs.
Right. Mach-E Vlog brings up another great point here. They also retooled the factory and have a 200,000 Mach-E annual run rate. So they have the capacity, if they can get all the parts, to build 200,000 Mach-E's a year, which is, that's serious volume. Like that's a high volume vehicle right there. We haven't seen a whole lot of that outside of Tesla so far. So that's good to see. I mean,
Will they sell that many? I mean, I know they can make them.
Right.
Will they sell that many?
That's right. Well, that's the competition part. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we'll have to see, I guess. So while we're talking before, I wanted to mention too that the Ford E-Transit is getting a bigger battery option. We were talking about the E-Transit earlier in the conversation. We don't have any details on it. We'll probably end up talking about this next week, but it's supposed to have 186 miles of range now. But I don't know if that's like the high roof version or probably just the lower roof version. It's probably the most optimistic, you know, the best range. But I mean, that brings up brings it up from like, was it, is it even over 100 miles, the high roof?
126.
Okay.
It's a 50% range increase.
Right, which is significant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's still not going to go quite as far as the new Mercedes E-Sprinter, though.
Okay.
The E-Sprinter is probably going to be EPA at like 225-ish.
Okay. Yeah, we'll have to see how they compare on price and packaging, too. Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be built in the U.S., the E-Sprinter.
Oh, nice. Yeah. All right. So the Tesla Model 3 long-range dual motor has been unavailable to order for some time now, but it has reappeared on the automaker's website this week. And it's a bit weird. So previously, the car had a 358-mile range. Now it has a 325-plus mile range, and it's only eligible for $3,750 in the tax credits, federal tax credit, instead of $7,500. So previous versions of this trim had a 0-60 time of 4.5 seconds, according to Tesla. That has been dropped to 4.2 seconds, so it's quicker in that respect. Let me just bring up the Tesla website here really quick with that so you can see these numbers. Right, so the, and I've clicked on the long range, okay. So the price starts at $47,240. That's $7,000 more than the rear-wheel drive version with 50 fewer miles of range, and $6,000 less than the Model 3 Performance, which only has like 10 fewer miles of range and is much quicker. So, but here's the thing. With the tax credit, the Performance is only $45,740. And the long range dual motor is $43,490. So that's after, you know, you do your taxes, that's a $2,250 difference, which is not much.
But doesn't the rear wheel drive get some tax credit too? It gets $3,750, right?
$3,750. Yeah, the rear wheel drive too. Right. Yep. The rear wheel, right. But so the distance between the Model 3 rear wheel drive and the Model 3 all wheel drive is, there's plenty of distance there, I think. But it's the long range to the Performance.
So is this going to be the first Project Highland Model 3? Is that what we're thinking?
I mean, it's coming pretty quick, right? So the
it hasn't been EPA tested yet because they don't give you a full mileage number. It's 325 plus, which means they don't know.
Did we know when the Highland is supposed to be unveiled? Because I believe this order is open up for this, like, now. I need to pull up the
And unveiled article. Might just be someone takes delivery and there it is at a dealer, right? You might just
see it. I don't think they're going to have an event around it.
Yeah, we don't know. We have no clue. But we also don't know much about this. Is it an LFP battery pack?
That's the thing. So that's the battery mystery. The cells are probably produced outside of the States, right? Which would be why it's only eligible for half the tax credit. But are they LFP batteries, or maybe they're 4680 cylindrical batteries from a foreign supplier? Because they've been talking about buying 4680s from somebody else. They've make it, that's kind of their own technology that they've developed, and they make them in Austin, I believe, right? Or no, they have the pilot factory in Fremont. And they also make them in Austin yet or not yet?
Mm-mm, no, not
just to Fremont.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but I believe other companies have been developing their own same form factor, that same size. So it could be, you know, sell from Panasonic, maybe from Japan. I'm not exactly sure. I haven't done my research on who else is making the 4680s right now, but I do know there was a number of companies looking at them.
Okay. Yeah. Not totally up to date on all of that. All I can say is it took them, 2 years to get Model 3 long range back on the,
menu
option. It's been a long time. I think the general consensus is it is LFP, but we'll have to see, of course. Right. And overall, can't wait to test it.
Yeah. So one of our viewers here, Donovan Lewis, says this is LFP and is not Highland. So there you have it. Maybe, I don't know if Donovan works for them or not, but he seems pretty sure about that. let's see. Anybody else? Yeah. I really don't know what's going on with that.
Someone says they do make 4680 in Austin, which I didn't know, which is cool.
Right. I know it's ever close to that, but there's still a lot going on. There's still being built in Austin. So yeah, I haven't looked in on that, the Gigafactory, actually, to see where they're at with that. I know
of a deal though is the rear wheel drive now. I mean,
yes.
You know, even, and I know I always say this here in New Jersey, we get an extra $4,000 cash on the hood. Now, that program halted because it ran out of funds like it does every year, but it's going to get refunded in July, I think first week in July. So you wait till July to buy a Model 3 in New Jersey. You get the base model with no options. You get the $3,750 federal tax credit. You get $4,000 cash on the hood and no sales tax exempt here in New Jersey. So out the door for like $32,000 for a new Model 3.
That's what I pay for my used Model 3 with like 46,000 miles on it. That's what's crazy. Epic. It's 5 years old.
So good.
It's a brand new one. Oh, man. Okay. So any thoughts, Tom, about the battery mystery? No?
We're just speculating. You know, it's LFP. I would guess it's LFP.
Mark put up an article about this. Called Reintroduced Tesla Model 3 Long Range All-Wheel Drive is confusing as hell. Range, price, battery. But yeah. And he made some arguments why maybe it's not the LFP battery. So he kind of thinks he's leaning 4680 actually in his article, but I don't know if he's had a chance to rethink that or look at other things or look at other arguments. But yeah, it's an interesting thing going on, and I guess we'll find out about it pretty soon. So another thing in the news this week is the Porsche Taycan is getting a bit of a refresh, and one of the test cars running around has been spotted with a huge wing on the back, leading some to believe that the automaker will offer a turbo GT version, which the car spies say could put out over 1,000 horsepower and maybe give the Tesla Model S Plaid a run for its money. So I don't know if Kyle, have you seen this, and would you trade in your Plaid for a Taycan if it was like as stupid fast?
Well, okay. So let's talk about, did I see it? Yes. And is it cool? Yes. And is Porsche the Germans in general need to understand what's going on here in America. You can buy a Lucid Air that rips. You can buy a Tesla Model S Plaid. Model S Plaids are like 105, 110. And they're like the fastest things on the planet. It's crazy, right? That level of performance per dollar. And what the Germans haven't done is, you know, kept up with any of that. And, you know, they need to, because the Taycan's a wonderful car. It's due for a refresh later this year anyway, going into next year. So we all knew that. And, you know, this car was a performance benchmark when it came out in terms of thermal management systems, in terms of acceleration, was right up there with P100D. That's why they put the dual transmission in there, mostly to give you that off the line and then the high speed. So I love how Porsche spent all this time to match Tesla, and then they just were like, oh, never mind, we got the new best thing coming right now. And I think it annoyed them a little bit. So this has to be like so much more than what they have right now in terms of hardcore performance to keep up with numbers on paper. And to be honest, I don't think it will be. I don't think they're going to be able to match Plaid. I don't think they're going to be able to match, you know, whatever comes that's faster than Plaid. You know, they're just waiting on a software update to unlock its full potential.
Well, because Lucid Sapphire, right?
But it doesn't exist yet.
Oh, but it will. Right.
Yeah. So when it does, then I think we'll start to see Tesla do Plaid Plus or do an upgrade pack. And they just launched the track pack for Model S yesterday.
Right. Which I was really about cool to mention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Over 200 miles an hour. I think 212 we've seen now from Sebastian Vittel, who drives on the Nürburgring. He has a great YouTube channel ripping his Plaid around the Nürburgring. He bought the carbon ceramic brakes and all that stuff and Martian wheels from Drew. And actually removed the carbon brakes and then put on the mountain pass brakes, is my understanding. So pretty much the same setup as my car, which is cool to see it ripping around the Nürburgring there. Tesla showed it going up to 200 miles an hour, 322 kph.
Right.
And just epic stuff. So Porsche, like, they have to do so much to compete with this on paper. And is that a race they want to get involved with? I don't know. I think they should. I think these types of benchmarking, collaborations, or not even, but competitions, spark innovation. And the Germans got to open it up. They got to stop being so conservative. The value for performance is not there. Even a rear wheel drive Taycan now, if you spec it nicely, is what a Plaid can do. And the performance delta is massive. Right. And,
just
keep it going.
There's still good reasons to buy the Taycan it feels so great to drive. It's I think a better feeling driving car probably than the Plaid.
Absolutely, especially when you spec some of the spicier ones. The base Taycan's pretty soft, but when you go Turbo S or even GTS, you know, they start to dial up the stuff.
Right. It just feels good. And, you know, the Plaid is like crazy speed and like mind-blowing. But it'd be nice if they could get some of that feel that, you know, Porsche has been able to develop over the decades, you know. They could get there, but yeah.
No one who drives a Model S is asking for more driving feel, except for me, basically.
Right. Well, I mean, there's some people that drivers out there have an idea.
I think there's like five. There's like five people who bought the Model S as a performance car, and the rest just do red light drag races.
Right. I don't know what you're talking about, red light drag races. All right. So that's all the main news we have, and we're just about up time, but I did want to mention that the Electrify America president or CEO to be, he's still the CEO elect or something. Robert Bourassa. He went on a cross country trip in his Ioniq 5. There he is. And just checking out the infrastructure to see. So he's going to take over this company. We've had him on the, we did a whole podcast special infrastructure episode with Robert talking about, the company and what they're planning on doing and everything. But now he's taken over, and, you know, we give Electrify America a hard time because right now it's like the only, you know, this is the biggest charging station for CCS cars right now. And it's not as reliable as, you know, we need it to be. And unfortunately they're carrying all the load for everybody. You know, EVgo isn't across the country. You can't really find them like you can Electrify America. So when Electrify America stations go down or have issues, it really affects people just more than you would want it to, right? So reliability is a huge issue for them. And, you know, he's going doing the, making the multi-day road trip across the country to experience it firsthand in Hyundai Ioniq 5, which is kind of nice. And I don't know, what did you think? I saw you posted something about this on LinkedIn and Twitter, congratulating them for it, Kyle, because you've been like one of their harshest critics. Like, man, I don't expect they return your phone calls, but
I don't ever call them. Right. I just post a video and they never respond. So
they don't reach out either. Right.
They obviously don't care because they could just send me an email. Whenever they email me, I've responded, but it's been like a year since I've heard from them.
Right. Right. Maybe that will change. We'll see.
Yeah, it's okay. They don't need to call me. So there's really nothing that we can do other than we just show up at Chargers and they should work, and they should work as advertised, and they should work perfectly. But this is a great step in the right direction. You know, we know Rob, and he's been on the show, and I know him personally. And I think this is a really good first step to see him, you know, start the process of maybe making the company a bit more transparent and getting out there. And I thought the press release was pretty dry, and it was like, oh, Rob did this and it was all great, and it took him 7 days to get across the country. And I was like, what? But then I watched the video, and I thought the video was really good. I think, you know, I'm sure he ran into more problems than what they showed. Yeah. But they were open about this thing's on the Windows screen. We're not getting the power that we're looking for. And so it's great to see him using the chargers that we all use often and get a real sense of what it takes to go on a road trip, because I don't think that's something we've seen before, to be honest. And from really any charging company executive. So really good stuff. Tom, I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I thought it was good that he, thank God he showed that there were problems. Cause I when I first heard that he was doing this video, I was just thinking to myself, just please don't drive across country and be like, oh, look, everything works. I don't know what people are complaining about. I didn't expect that from Rob, because I think he's genuine. You know, we had him here on the show. Kyle, I don't think you were here that day. You were flying one of your European trips or something when we did that.
I've spent time with Rob in person. Yeah. I know him pretty well. Yeah.
Yeah. He seems like a real legitimate down to earth guy that is going to try to do the best he can, you know. But now that doesn't mean president and CEO of a company, it doesn't mean you can just dictate everything the company does. He does report to Volkswagen, you know, who ultimately pulls all the strings in Electrify America. Right. But I thought he did a good job. I thought he showed that there's challenges and showed that there were problems with the app, and he had to call customer service. I think this was fairly representative of a cross-country drive, albeit there could have been more problems, or he could have gotten lucky. And this could have been, he could have shown all the problems. That's the thing about it. You're not, you can get some, I've taken trips where I've used multiple Electrify America chargers, not had a single problem. And then I've had other trips where it's just problem after problem after problem. So, you know, he could literally, he legitimately could have shown every problem he had. It's possible. It's probably unlikely, but it's possible. And you also have to understand some people, you know, he did show that the reduced charging power. I didn't think they would show that. I thought he would show a successful charging stop as one where he goes and plugs in and it charges the vehicle and not really talk about the kilowatt draw. He, to his credit, he showed, oh, wow, this should be pulling more now, which I think that's where some people might disagree in whether it's a successful charge or not. If you and I pull up in an Ioniq 5, we want to see, you know, 200 kilowatts for a while. If somebody sees 140 or 150, and as they walk into the Walmart or wherever they are to go to the bathroom and maybe grab something, they're fine with that. So that's not acceptable for us, and it shouldn't be acceptable for the industry. But what the point I'm trying to bring is that is a little bit of a gray area with regards to what's successful charging. I think everybody would say if it pulled 40 kilowatts, it's not a successful charging event. But for some people that go in, if they're getting 70% of what they should and they leave at an acceptable level after waiting an acceptable amount of time, they're fine with that. So the problem is, how do we determine what do we stick to Kyle Connor's standards, which I understand is if it's not delivering exactly what it should, it's unsuccessful. Or do we say, well, I left there in a reasonable time and I charged and I left. I think Electrify America would say, if as long as the charger works reasonably well and you're able to plug in and get a charge and leave, we consider that successful. And that's something that I think we should try to reach out to Rob for and try to have a continuing conversation on what's his view of that personally, you know, and as opposed to, because we've heard from the comms people at Electrify America, we've heard from the people that say, look, you know, if somebody goes in and plugs in and gets a charge, all right, even if it took them an extra 10 minutes, that's a successful charge. I'd love to hear what Rob thinks about that. And that might help us get a better idea of where he wants to take the company.
Yeah. For our rate your charge check-ins, we do, you know, this is the conversations we're having every day as to how do we quantify these things.
Yeah.
And right now we have it very basic. We have a good charging session, which counts as you got the expected power, you know, because the charger's able to deliver everything. No one, you know, no major issues or anything like that. And you're good to go. So that's a good check-in. A bad check-in is you were able to charge, but not at the expected rate because of a charging problem, not because of the car's battery being cold. And then we have a failed check-in, which is you were not able to charge at all. So, yep, that's how we rate it right now for rate your charge.
All right. Well, I think that probably brings us to the end of our show. Anything else anybody want to add anything before we go?
Well, really quickly about Kyle's rating. I think there's a good section of the population of EV drivers that don't understand what it should be pulling at a certain state of charge and at a certain temperature. So those people leave very satisfied, even though we would have given it a fail. You know what I mean? So that's what I was trying to communicate before with that long rambling comment I just made. It was hard to really figure out the right way to explain what I'm talking about. That deciding whether it's a successful charging session or not, it's not black and white to a lot of people. And that's, I'd love to hear Electrify America's opinion on that, like, you know, and how they address that and how they view what a successful charging session is.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a whole lot. We should get in touch with them and see if they'll talk to us, because we're pretty harsh on them, but hopefully they'll understand that that's our job. We have to be, you know, we're just telling it what we experience.
I mean, we have to be, but we are.
I mean, kind of have to be.
But it's not just on them, it's on everyone. It's just, I think we treat every CPO the same. You know, even though I just went to ChargePoint, did that whole 2-hour long video, if I roll up to a ChargePoint charger that's broken or doesn't work, I'm the first one to post on Twitter about it and blast all that. Same with FreeWire, same with Autel, same with ChemPower. Companies that, you know, give us access doesn't mean we give them better ratings out in the public. We're still just as harsh no matter what.
Yeah. All right. So how about now? Is that the end of our show?
I think we're done.
Okay. All right. See if I can get all these little things done. But thanks for that's the end of our show. If you have any questions or comments, you can leave them on the Inside EVs forum podcast thread or on our YouTube or Twitch comment sections. If you like the show, please give us a thumbs up if you're watching us on YouTube. If you didn't like the show, please give us a thumbs up if you're watching us on YouTube. Don't forget you can find and follow our panelists on Twitter. Follow Tom Alogny at Tomalog, that's with two M's. Martin Lee, when he's here and when he's not here, he's at EV News Daily. And Kyle Connor is at it's Kyle Connor. I'm at Dominic on post.news and Mastodon. Click subscribe, tap that bell icon for notifications. Thank you all very much for joining us, and we'll see you again next week. And ciao.
And hang out, because Dom always forgets how to shut the show off, so we might be going on longer.